Welcome to Mountain Money. You're listening to Allison Kulo and guest host, Kimberly Flores.
The return to office is in full swing, and company culture is on every leader's mind as they roll out new on-site amenities, wellness programs, and even Lizzo concerts to get people excited about being back at the office. But the focus on great perks is just one example of a misguided yet common approach to culture. For years, too many leaders have approached culture in a fragmented way, focusing on perks and nebulous values without integrating them into the organizational system. In reculturing, design your company culture to connect with strategy and purpose for lasting success, Melissa Daimler argues that it's crucial to take systems approach to culture and offers a systematic approach for redesigning a company's culture as both work and the world evolve. Melissa, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's begin with having you tell us about why you wrote the book and how long did it take you to write it?
Oh boy, it depends on who you ask. I actually wrote the book because I have been in tech for over 20 years. It's some pretty amazing companies with Twitter and Adobe, who had some fantastic cultures. And I've also been at companies that frankly had cultures that weren't so healthy. And I have been struggling with the definition of culture for many years, reading a lot of books and every research paper out there, and it felt like a very nebulous definition. And I believe that culture is more than just an organization's personality or kind of what the boss does or what you do when the boss leaves the room. It's something that you can design intentionally. And I think over the last couple of years with this pandemic, we realized that you do not need an office to have culture. You actually can create culture, and it is more about how people work with each other.
You did mention when culture is kind of a little bit misguided, and we know that you worked for WeWork for quite some time. Tell us about the culture there and, you know, what you tried to fix there.
I think WeWork was a great learning opportunity, and, you know, I have written and thought a lot about it since I've left. I think going back to your introduction, part of my studies throughout my entire career has been really looking at organizations as a total system. And I think we miss the huge opportunity that culture is when we don't connect it to what we're doing with our business and where we're going with our strategy and why we're operating, what is our purpose. So I think one of the big lessons from WeWork, you know, there's all these great, you know, there's a docuseries out now, there's books, there's movies. And a lot of it focuses on Adam Neumann, the CEO. Mm-hmm. And while he has, you know, many faults, I don't think it just was because, you know, the fault of that company going down wasn't just because of Adam. It was because of the system. There were, very junior people at the leadership team level. It wasn't a diverse team. You had a lot of people who were somewhat complicit with Adam and not willing to push back. So organizationally, the structure, I would say, had some misplacements. I think the strategy got lost. You know, we weren't just focused on real estate, and it certainly wasn't connected to the culture. I think the values there were brilliant. They were different. They were beautiful neon lights on a wall, but they weren't translated into any kind of behavioral day-to-day action. And that's more of what I talk about in my book.
So with that day-to-day behavioral action, maybe it would help us to have you then understand culture. Like, you know, I think of many companies, they think a culture is providing perks. You know, a culture is mm-hmm. having more laid back attitude. But as you're saying, if they're not tied in or connected with what you do on a daily basis, that's not what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that values is a good place to start with culture. But I think often like WeWork, like a lot of companies, you can't just stop at the list of values. What means, you know, a value that is meaningful at one company, let's say innovation, could have a very different meaning at another company. And so unless you codify that a bit more into specific behaviors, you're not really clear about what's expected with your employees. So I'll give you an example. I was working with two different companies, both of which wanted to have the value of innovation. But when you dug deeper, some of the things they were trying to drive, one was trying to drive more ideas, more prototyping, much quicker pace. The other one wanted to slow down. They felt like their ideas were too quick to market. They weren't thinking through what it is they were trying to really do with customers. And so they had two different behaviors. One was we prototype quickly, and one was we ask each other why. So very different approaches to bringing innovation into the organization. And so what I recommend, and we're doing this at Udemy, and I've done this with quite a few companies, is go further with your values. Really think about what those specific behaviors are so that you can then embed culture into all of these things that we are familiar with. So processes like how to hire, how to onboard, how to promote, how to recognize, all of those can represent the behaviors that you've defined at the company. Mm-hmm.
Is this something that a company has to start with right when it's building its like mission and value statement? Or if someone listening today going, you know what, that's us. We're not quite where we need to be with our value system. How does one go and deep dive, do an investigation into their system to find out if their culture is really working for them?
I think that you need to look at your culture, whether you're, you know, one person or 10,000 people. I mean, part of the reason I called it reculturing is because culture is a verb. It's a very active word. It's not just a one-time initiative that you do at some point with HR and then you're done. So I think as new businesses, as you know, very mature businesses today who are kind of re-looking at where they're going and even how to approach you know, this next phase of the year and dealing with all the macroeconomic issues, culture and looking at your behaviors is a really important exercise. So I would say if you haven't identified your values, first identify those. And then think about questions like, you know, on a good day, what are we doing? You know, when are we effective? What are some of our high performers doing consistently? When we are being effective with our goals, what did we do as an organization or as a team to get there? And so you're kind of working backwards and mm-hmm. thinking through, you know, what are those success factors that will help you come up with those behaviors so that you can repeat them?
Mm-hmm. And so how do you then, once you identify those behaviors, communicate that to the company? I know you had mentioned, you know, as part of the investigation, what are the high performers doing? I don't anticipate that, you know, we'd be highlighting and spotlighting those that perform good and well instead of those that perform poorly. How do we do this?
I really believe that culture, like defining culture, is a co-creation. I think it's not just something that executive teams should be doing at the top, and I don't think it's, you know, something that employees can just create on their own. I think it's co-created from executives and employees. And so I think together, this is an opportunity for having conversations around, you know, what do we want to see more of at our organization? What's working? What's not working? And so I think the discussion starts with the executive team because you want to understand, you know, what they want to see more of. But I think then that has to, whatever they come up with, those conversations need to then be facilitated with the employees as well. And it's kind of a messy process, but you get to a point where you can ultimately define, you know, a set of behaviors that you can observe, that are positively focused, that are culturally relevant. You know, I think in Silicon Valley, we like to use a lot of idioms, you know, don't sweat the small stuff, hustle harder. And I just think that's confusing, especially to global companies. You know, is somebody in Tokyo going to understand don't sweat the small stuff? So making behaviors as simple as possible and clear so that when it comes time for me to give you feedback on your performance, I can then leverage those. And it's going to be much easier for me to know what I'm giving you feedback on in the realm of how you're working when I have that playbook of behaviors that we have already defined for ourselves.
Right, and then that way everyone's playing from the same playbook. I like that a lot.
Exactly.
I know that many companies are still a little flex. Most are working from home, many are back in the office, but I did want to touch on this new phenomenon that the pandemic has kind of created where it's very flexible, but companies are wanting to bring some of their employees back. So I wanted to talk with you about like what some companies are doing, what are they getting wrong about trying to lure their employees back with like on-site amenities, or, you know, I want to hear about this Lizzo concert that we mentioned in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest question I'm hearing right now is how do we bring our culture back? And it's the wrong question. And it's funny because I have to remind people that, you know, we didn't love everything about our work pre-pandemic. You know, people complained about the commute. We didn't love everything about the office. And so I think we have such an opportunity to redesign what culture is now. Work has changed. Like you said, there's a more of a hybrid environment that a lot of companies are trying to figure out. And so I think if we can just clarify that culture is not just what happens at an office, that is a huge distinction and reframe. I think I'm all for ping pong games and great food, but a lot of leaders are saying, hey, if we bring back, you know, Wednesday, Thursday lunches, we'll get people back. And I almost think that's disrespectful, you know, or almost condescending to think that people will come back just for a sandwich. So I think we have to be much more intentional about how we're using the office. And you know, a lot of companies like LinkedIn and Cloudflare have redesigned their entire office experience so that there's many more brainstorming rooms, opportunities for people to still do individual work, but with other people. There's conference rooms now that have huge TVs so that you can do the hybrid. If, you know, some people are never able to come into the office, they can still work. So I think we need to be much more intentional about bringing people back into the office. So instead of just asking, how do we bring our culture back? We need to be thinking through, you know, what are some reasons that people would come back to the office? You know, what are some things that are harder to do virtually? Like, you know, team development, team effectiveness, you know, getting people together just to socially get to know each other. Those decisions that are so much harder virtually to make, perhaps, you know, that could be managed and decided in 2 hours in person. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where we need to start looking and really not, again, think that culture is only at the office and then you don't have culture when you're at home. You are creating culture, you know, in every conversation and every decision, whether you're at the office or not. So I think intentionality is the key word here.
An element of rising priority in many companies is working towards, you know, diversity and inclusion, and how those concepts, as you say, aren't separate concepts. They should be put together. Can you talk a little bit more about those skills?
Sure. When the unconscious bias training came out, I remember, you know, I thought that it was a red herring because I think a lot of companies said, hey, if we just put everybody through an unconscious bias training, we're good. And we all know it is much more than that. I think just like culture is an active set of behaviors diversity and inclusion is as well. I think we all are realizing that we need to actively be an ally. We need to be actively pulling people into conversations. We need to actively be looking for diverse talent as we're interviewing. And so, you know, one of the things that I have worked with a lot of companies around, and we've done this at Udemy, is maybe not create just a value and a set of behaviors that have to do with D&I. I think the companies that are reinforcing and modeling what DEI is, those are the behaviors that are threaded throughout every value. And so I think that is a really important distinction, that it's diversity is not just one value, but it should be embedded into all of your values and behaviors. And so a skill like, you know, how to be an ally is something that we're talking a lot about. So how do you make sure, again, in a very simple practice in a meeting, make sure that everybody has an opportunity to share their point of view, making sure that we're thinking about inclusivity as we're building events, or even the time of when we're doing meetings. Are we including everybody, even the people that are permanently remote? How do we include them into the conversation? So I think there's a lot of more complexity now that we are in a hybrid, more companies are in hybrid environments, to really think through how we can be intentionally diverse with each other.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about the four dangerous gaps that derail company culture and drive talent away. Can you walk through those with us?
Sure. I hope I remember them. I think the gaps, what I talk a lot about with the book is that one of the big pieces that we're not doing is we're not connecting those core pieces that I talked about earlier about strategy. So one of them is culture and strategy. So Peter Drucker is famous for saying culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I jokingly say that, you know, I actually think they should sit down and have breakfast together. I don't think one is better than the other. I think that both can be leveraged. And so when a company is shifting strategy, I know when we were at Adobe, I think I was there for almost 11 years, and we evolved our strategy in a major way, three or four different times. And each time we paused and said, you know, hey, we also need to look at our culture and think through how our values and behaviors have evolved as well. So I think connecting those more is really key. We talked about values and behaviors. Don't just create a list of values, but really think through how those behaviors can be expressed through each one of those values and actually observed. The other gap I talk about is between behaviors and processes. We haven't talked about this much, but the processes like hiring, onboarding, feedback, recognition, making sure that once you identify those behaviors, those are embedded into your all of those processes. And so instead of going back to diversity and instead of having a culture fit when you're hiring people, I think it's really important that we reframe that to be more of like a culture complement or a culture add. And I think you can do that really well when you have the behaviors embedded into those hiring questions. And then the other gap I talk about is behaviors and practices. I think practices are more of those informal kind of day-to-day kind of actions. So the meetings we have, the ways that we connect, how we communicate in different forums. Behaviors don't have to necessarily be embedded into each one of these, but it's important to make sure that we keep that connection. So for example, if I think I talk about the book is if there's a behavior, we say what needs to be said, then, actively encouraging people in meetings, especially the quieter people, to make sure that they had an opportunity to say what they wanted to say. Or if we empower decisions at the lowest level, You know, are we making sure that when we make a decision, we've included people, you know, at the front line into that decision? Mm-hmm. So those are some of the gaps.
One of the things that you talk about is not just the importance of when that person is an existing employee, but the importance of an employee's exit interview. How do we get it right? How is that best used?
I think the exit interview is such a key moment for an organization that often gets missed. I think being able to take a step back and ask questions with that employee around, you know, hey, what could we've done better? What could have made your experience better, such that you wouldn't be leaving right now? I think managers can also get a lot of feedback from exiting employees. You know, what could I have done better as an employee? But I also think that this is an opportunity to exemplify your culture as well. You know, the companies that I've left that have treated me well and treated me respectfully and have consistently, have been consistent with their culture and their behaviors, I still talk about today, and I refer people today. So I just think it's important that we all remember, even when somebody's exiting, that, you know, culture has an opportunity to show up intentionally there as well. And so often you're hearing today these boomerangs. You know, many more people are coming back to organizations that they left, realizing that the grass isn't so green and they actually had a good gig going on. So if they were treated respectfully right to the end, that actually has them think differently about applying again for the future at the same company.
Yeah. I think just the book about reculturing, you talking about it not being a one-time initiative and wanting to be an organization that's constantly learning, I think that's really what you're trying to say is the end-all be-all goal here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that because I think culture is such an active set of behaviors, so often I hear people saying we want a culture of learning and we want to build more of a learned environment, but there's not a lot of clarity about what they want, what skills they want to build. And so I think having the foundation of those behaviors, I mean, I'll give you an example at Udemy, where one of our values is always learning, no surprise. But we have just gone through this process and realized that as we're growing, one of the ways for us to learn behaviorally is to have more constructive debate with each other. But a lot of our employees don't know how to do that. So how do we then, as an organization, make sure our employees know the skills to debate each other in a constructive way? And so I think a lot of companies stop short of really providing those learning opportunities and experiences to embed some of these behaviors into the organization and help employees build the skills to keep that culture alive.
We've been speaking with Melissa Daimler. She is the author of Reculturing, Design Your Company Culture to Connect with Strategy and Purpose for Lasting Success. Melissa, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Professional communication has become more complex than ever. With the rise of remote working and the increasing prominence of social media, we frequently find ourselves muted, a time when we can't find the opportunities to speak up or our ideas aren't getting the credit they deserve. In the book Unmuted, author Heather Hansen draws upon her years of experience as a communication specialist and consultant to illustrate how you can overcome these obstacles and make your voice heard. Heather, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with, how did you come to write this book and this topic?
Well, I've been working in the world of global communication for 15 years in my own corporate services firm, and I'm based in Singapore. I've been living abroad for 20 years, born and raised in California, So I've been deep in this subject for quite some time. And as we moved into the pandemic, I was watching my clients really struggle to find their voice. We moved online, we went into Zoom calls, and suddenly the first thing that we heard was, "You're on mute, you're on mute, you're on mute, can't hear you." And one day I just realized, wow, we've actually been on mute for a long time, long before the pandemic. But the pandemic really brought that into focus. We were all struggling. We didn't know how to speak up for what we really needed. And I realized, yeah, it was time that we all started to press that unmute button and show up and speak up in the world. So there were a few things going on that came together, just frustration with being a corporate trainer and dumping lots of training on people that wasn't really making a change because we weren't looking at the right things. And then losing trust in some of our leadership and wondering, why is the world looking the way it looks right now? And why does it seem to not be getting better? And so I think we need a lot more voices in the world, a lot more people speaking up and sharing their great ideas so that we can move forward.
Early on in the book, you share something that is the basis of the unmuted framework. And as a visual learner, the idea that you set it out in a Venn diagram was terribly appealing. But can you sort of help our listeners who won't have the benefit of that diagram sort of explain what you mean by the unmuted framework?
Sure. Yeah, the unmuted framework, it is a Venn diagram, as you mentioned. So if you imagine these three circles that are overlapping, it's looking at conscious communication, which is cultural awareness, self-awareness, the ability to feel what others are feeling, have more empathy, and be conscious of the people around us and what we're discussing. Then we have confident communication, which includes both your self-confidence and also skills confidence. So feeling like you know how to give a good presentation, you know how to stand up and speak. And then the final piece is connected communication, which is feeling like you belong in your environment, that you're included, that your voice is being heard, that you're acknowledged, that you have good relationships and a sense of psychological safety in your workplace. So when all these three things overlap, we then can be truly unmuted. But what's probably more interesting than those three big areas are the overlaps. So if you are very connected in your environment and very confident, but you lack that consciousness, that self-awareness and awareness of others, then your voice can tend to be too loud. You dominate the discussion, you interrupt, and you often don't know you're doing it. You might end up even being offensive in the worst case, but you don't realize it. And then if you were confident and conscious, but didn't have that connection, didn't feel like you belonged or people valued what you say, then you tend to go on mute. That's when people just start to disappear. They say, you know what? I give up. I'm tired of trying to make a point here and having people cut me down every time. They go on mute. And then the final group are the ones who are connected and conscious, but maybe are lacking that confidence. And they're just turning their voices down. They're too soft. They aren't speaking up and sharing their ideas as much as they could and making the impact on the world that they're really capable of. So that's the overview of that framework. And the entire book goes into those three elements of conscious, confident, and connected communication to show us how we can enhance our skills in all of those areas to be truly balanced and unmuted in our families, in our work, in our communities, in the world.
I want to start with that latter group, those that perhaps may be lacking the confidence. It seems that for me, I tend to talk with people who say like, oh, well, my voice doesn't matter, or I'm okay, I can just handle it. How do you start to help people understand that their voice is important?
That's such a great point, Allison, you know, because I think so many of us think, you know, who am I to speak up? Who am I to say that? You know, nobody's going to listen to me, or my story isn't important, but we all have really important stories to tell. And all of our lives are so unique. Our experiences are so unique, and we all have something to bring to the table. So it is just so important that we realize that, yes, I do have a place in this world. I do have something to say. And that starts with the self-worth and the self-confidence, as well as self-awareness about the fact that you could be lacking that. And this is deep work. You know, I wrote the book, but it's just scratching the surface of these topics. And I hope that people will dig even deeper and think about the things that I've written and continue with additional activities. And there are a number of ways that we do that in the book, as well as some additional tools that are related to the book. But it takes a lot of time and thought and self-reflection as you work through the book, this process of unmuting. And I think it is a lifelong process. Even writing the book for me was my own process of unmuting my voice. And I came up against those barriers where I thought, will anyone really want to read this? And is this really worth saying? Are people going to think this is dumb? And so I myself in my work, in my career, you know, have had to rise up to that challenge and also unmute my own voice in the process.
So if the first step is deciding you have something to say, isn't the next step figuring out how to get people to listen? How do you get someone to listen?
Oh, that's a great question. I think we first need to be good listeners. We all tend to think that we're great listeners. It's other people who don't listen to us. But all of us have challenges in listening. So sometimes we're listening to finish what the person's saying. Sometimes we're listening to find a solution for them. You know, we love to say, oh, we finish each other's sentences, you know, as if we're falling in love and we're so connected. But that actually isn't a great thing, because it means that we aren't allowing others to finish their full thoughts. We aren't giving the space for others to speak their truth. So I think we first need to learn how to be better listeners before we expect others to listen to us. But listening is a huge part of being unmuted, knowing when to also press the mute button and listen and give space for others' ideas.
A big part of listening to others is also being aware of your own perceptions, because they may be saying one thing, but depending on our filters or our perspective, we may be hearing something different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a really good point. I see this every day, especially because I personally am living in such an international environment. I live in Singapore now, and every interaction I am in is multinational, multilingual, multicultural. And so I see this very, very clearly. But it's important to remember, even if you never leave your living room, if you're working remotely, if you've never traveled outside the country, every interaction you're having is a multicultural one. Intercultural is the same as interpersonal. You can grow up down the block from someone and have very different perspectives of the world. So having an awareness of what your possible biases are, what your upbringing has taught you, what your education has given you, we all have very unique ways of seeing the world. And when we are listening, if we are not aware of those perspectives that we carry and those biases that we have, it's really easy to just not listen to people, to not take them seriously, to think because they sound a certain way, they look a certain way, they're a certain gender, they're a certain age, a fill in the blank, that maybe what they're saying doesn't really apply to me and I don't really need to listen to that. So we do have to be incredibly aware, self-aware of our filters, as you say, and the perspective that we're bringing to the world, so that we aren't discounting anyone, any of these voices, because we've become so used to listening to the same people, the same voices, the same dominating voices. And it's time for us to really start giving more credit to the people who we don't always listen to, and the quieter voices in our societies, in our workplaces, even possibly in our families. And so that's an excellent point, Allison. I'm really glad you brought that up.
One of the things you do in the book that's kind of fun is sort of put out these lessons about how to help people speak more confidently and to communicate more effectively. Let's talk about a few of them. One of the things that I thought was really fun was the way you talk about how important it is to present yourself on a Zoom screen.
Absolutely. Because when we moved online, everybody kind of froze. What do I do? How do I look? Now I see myself all day. And how do I set up my my screen, and I've been on so many calls where you see more ceiling than the person's face, or you only see their eyebrows and their forehead, or, and we have to realize, okay, in the very beginning of the pandemic, this was okay. It was forgivable. But now that we're coming out on the other side, and we still are, remote work is here to stay. We will still be in many, many online calls, video calls. And we need to learn how to show up professionally, just as if we were walking into the room at the office in a meeting. And so I think it's really important to give people the skills to feel confident showing up, because the confidence comes, first of all, from your self-worth, but also the skills that you have. So if you don't feel like you can handle the tech, then you can never show up with confidence. You're too worried about, oh, can they hear me? And is my camera on? And did I do this right? And how do I look? And how do I sound? And you become so self-conscious that you never speak up in that meeting. So I think it's really important to try to balance the theory of the book as well with some very practical tools around language, around communication, presentation, Zoom calls, et cetera. So I have tried to balance that a bit to also give people some very actionable tools and ideas and strategies for showing up with confidence.
And there's some good ones. I mean, even things like camera positioning. I know that, like it or not, I know that I react differently in terms of thinking about whether someone is really prepared to do a meeting properly by whether or not they've taken the time to have an appropriate background, to have appropriate lighting, to have the camera positioned so it's not looking up at them and giving them a double chin, even though they're not that old. So, I mean, I thought your sort of illustrations were fantastic. There were some other ones.
That's so true. So true. Yeah. And in the book, we even have a picture of the before and the after, which I was a bit embarrassed about. I sent that to the publisher saying, can you just make up some kind of picture like this? I said, oh, no, we like yours. And the pictures of me.
Oh, is that you?
Yeah, it's actually me in the book. And I'm going, no, we really don't have to use those. You know, my before picture was literally rolling out of bed one morning, opening my laptop and taking a really horrible picture of myself. And I thought, oh no, now this is going to be in the book. But you get the real deal. We're very unmuted in this book.
Absolutely. I think with regards to the lessons, what you talk about is more about how you're saying things, not what you're saying, because you speak about body language and grammar. How did, you know, this additionally help unmute people?
I talk a lot about the language, especially because people tend to believe they need to be perfect, that they have to have the perfect words, the perfect grammar. And I'm always saying, and my own personal mantra as well, that I always try to remind myself of, is that it's about connection, not perfection. That if you have a grammar error, who cares? If you read an email that has an error, who cares? You know, social media is littered with the grammar police, and we're all on our high horses trying to tell others how they should communicate, when really, if you have understood the message, isn't that good enough? Isn't that the whole goal of communication, that you're able to express yourself and someone else understands the meaning? I think often we're so focused on the actual words that we forget about focusing on the meaning behind it. And then we hold that against people for all the wrong reasons. So that's what I'm mostly trying to talk about when it comes to grammar, when it comes to body language, to not read into these things too much, to focus on connecting and building the relationship. And through doing that, you can feel more confident about being your authentic self in those interactions and showing up fully.
As we wrap up this interview, I just want to quickly touch upon the interactive experience that you are including within this book. Can you just give a brief overview of how it's more than just a book?
Yeah, as I was kind of alluding to earlier, in addition to the book itself, there is a discussion guide. So there's a video that goes with every chapter and a self-reflection PDF file that you can download to follow along or use it in a book group or a discussion group or in to start conversations at work, for example. There's also an unmuted assessment that you can take to find out, you know, are you leaning towards being too loud or too soft, or are you on mute, or are you too confident? What's going on in your own communication? And then finally, there is an implementation tool for companies who want to create an unmuted environment at work and steps that they can take to begin bringing this culture into their own workplace. So I really wanted the book to be more than than just a simple theoretical read. I wanted to give people the opportunity to dig much deeper into the content and really learn over time. So I hope that people do appreciate and dig into those resources.
We've been speaking with the author of Unmuted, How to Show Up, Speak Up, and Inspire Action. Heather Hansen, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Jason Fowler, president of RNC International, is joining us this morning from Washington, D.C. to talk about what they're looking forward to at this event this week. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So please take a moment and tell us a little bit about your business and relationship with Goldman Sachs' 10,000 Small Businesses Education Program.
Yeah, RNC International is a freight forwarder and customs house broker located in Murray, Utah. My father started the company in 1985. We have about 25 employees. With logistics background, it being as crazy it was, I'm a graduate of the Goldman program about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's really helped me understand my business. I graduated with a philosophy and English degree from the University of Utah. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a business background, and the Goldman program really intensifies what you should do to grow and make your business successful. It's been a fantastic learning experience.
So knowing that you've been able to go through that program and gain steps that help you become more successful, what are you hoping to gain by being in Washington, D.C. with all these other business owners?
Yeah, there's about 2,500 business owners here at this meeting. It's absolutely huge for small business. What we're really seeking is to have our representatives reauthorize the SBA. There's four large areas that we're really looking to, gain some traction on. The first is access to capital, workplace benefits for our employees, specifically for me, healthcare is a major issue I'd like to discuss with them if we have the time. Affordable childcare and access to federal contracts for small businesses to put us on a level playing field.
How did you come up with this agenda, or is it something that you all gathered together with the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses on what the four key pieces of advocacy that you're looking for?
Yeah, Goldman did a survey of all the small businesses in their program, and these were the top four that kept coming up, and they were the most important to us. With authorizing the SBA, it hasn't been done since the year 2000, so as you can imagine, mm-hmm. 22 years of progress has not really caught up with the SBA, and we really need it to change to help small businesses grow because we're such a large part of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Is this going to be your first time advocating as a small business owner on Capitol Hill?
Goldman had a summit in 2018 that was smaller, and we did get to meet with one representative, but it was very nominal. So this is my first time. I think we're meeting with three of the two senators and one congressman on Wednesday. So this will, realistically, it's my first time.
And I know that for many, it can be intimidating, your first time going and talking to elected officials, but that's what we're supposed to do. That's part of our democracy. So how do you guys prepare to be able to go into those meetings?
As the voice of small business, we really just have to, make our voices heard. Small business makes up the majority of businesses in the country. We pay the most taxes and hire and have the most employees. So we're really a voice to be heard and reckoned with, especially when we're en masse here in D.C. I think people will sit up and pay attention. Because mm-hmm. we really need a level playing field to compete with, larger national and multinational companies.
One of the things you mentioned was access to government contracts. Is that something that, with the reauthorization of the SBA, that would take place, or is that just a separate request as part of these efforts?
They're the four big areas that we need to have updated in the reauthorization of the SBA. For me, the biggest area that I want to concentrate on is my workplace benefits for my employees. We pay for all of our employees' health care, and every month it is just a staggering amount, especially for a small business, and to put that burden on businesses as a whole is very cumbersome, and it restricts our growth.
Mm-hmm. You're going to be meeting with 70, or going to D.C. with 70 small business owners here from Utah. What's your relationship like with these other small business owners?
You know, with the pandemic, it's been very hard to have some alumni events from the Goldman program. But previously, we've all gotten together, you know, once every couple of months and had networking events. And it's great to be able to connect with other small business owners. You really have a lot in common, you know, the day-to-day grind and trials and tribulations. And it's great because you can learn from others, you know, mistakes that I've made, I can pass on to somebody who's maybe in a similar situation, and they can avoid those things.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about the goals of the actual 10,000 Small Businesses program. Now, is this advocacy piece something new, something that just came up because the SBA is so outdated? Or how does advocacy work into the curriculum of that program?
This is new. As far as I know, this is the first time. We haven't had a summit like this, you know, because of COVID and that, but it's been 4 years. And I believe this is the advocacy. It's laser focused on these four areas and to get the SBA reauthorized. It is just so important to have that backdrop for small businesses, something they can lean on, especially that's updated, you know, to help us grow.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that you all volunteered for, or were you chosen for this event? How did you get your ticket, I guess, to D.C.?
Yeah, so you have we're all alumni of the program, and to be part of the program, you need to apply. It's a very simple, easy thing to do to apply. You do have to send in some fairly detailed financial information, but they use that information to help you understand what's going on in your business. The curriculum itself for the Goldman program is intensive for a small business owner because it does take one day a week to be completely out of your business for, I think it's about a 3-month period of time. So it is difficult because of the time commitment as a small business owner, but it really helped me. Like I said, I was a philosophy and English major, and I entered into the field of logistics, didn't really have a background in business. And as you've heard, with the logistics, as it's been, especially last year, we had unprecedented growth. And so it really helped me navigate the explosive growth we have. But now, as things have calmed down, it's helped me pivot and, you know, trying to find new customers where we couldn't, you know, we couldn't bring on any customers last year. So it really, really has helped me focus on how to best run my company.
Many people that I know who have been part of the program, the greatest benefit that they feel is this isn't like going and getting an MBA, because this is actually working on your business. As you said, your application includes your financials. You're not studying necessarily other businesses. You're working on your own. Can you share maybe a few aha moments you had as you were going through that?
Yeah, the most helpful thing for me, I think, in the whole program was the financial information that they give you. We used to print out our balance sheet and profit and loss and our cash flow statements. You know, we'd bring them up to our CPA and he would look over them, and those numbers to me didn't really mean much. You know, were we profitable? Were we not profitable? But the Goldman program, and specifically that module, really helped me understand exactly what I was looking at. I now run my own reports. You know, I'm bringing things to my CPA's attention that he wouldn't have caught because he doesn't run the business. So that, for me, that was the most helpful part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. I know that you're an alumni of the program and not exactly working for Goldman in this arena, but can you tell us a little bit about some of the qualifications that you have to meet to be accepted into the program?
Let me think. It's you can be a fairly small business. You know, I can't give you the details because it's been so long since I've done them. I think you have to have 3 employees and maybe have a gross revenue of a couple $100,000. So it really does, you know, focus towards, you know, 1 or 2 people maybe the upper limits of what we'd call a small business.
And the one thing, as you said too, the program asks you to spend one day of week kind of, you know, out of the business. And I think that was a huge benefit for many people I know, because a lot of times, you know, it's working in the business or working on the business.
That's exactly right. They always talk about you need to work, you know, on your business. You need to take a step back and really look at the macro scale of your business, because sometimes as small business owners, we're really in the minutia all the time and micromanaging everything, because and they let you give you the tools, I should say, to take that step back, to hire people that you can trust and know that they're going to do a good job.
Well, we've been speaking with Jason Flower. He's the president of RNC International and is calling from Washington, D.C. as he takes part in Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Summit. Jason, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. Do you love Mountain Money? Let us know. Leave us a review.